Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Angela Alberti.
Hello, Ivy Podcast listeners. Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. I am your host, Angela Alberti. Wherever you are tuning in from around the world, we want to thank you guys so much for spending a few moments of your time with us. And I have the absolute honor and pleasure, very excited about who I'm going to be interviewing today on the show. Wen Stenger, when you have a solid background within the human capital space, I think you provide a lot of insight on the buyer side, on the staffing side, as far as the intermediary in between. You know, this ecosystem that we are part of is just unique and is made up from many different angles, which you bring a lot of insight to. Wen, can you give us a little bit of background on who you are? I guess that 90-second elevator pitch.
Oh, I have to keep it to 90 seconds. All right, I'm a talker. Wen Stenger, CEO and co-founder of Omni Inclusive. When it comes to background, you know, I start from my HR roots. Right out of high school, I joined the Air Force and spent 8 years active duty, all stateside. But that role was as a personnel manager. And I enjoyed that work in the Air Force so much that I went to college while I was active duty to complete my bachelor's in human resources. And then ventured out into the civilian world in 2004. And so since that time, I have had a little over 17 years experience in the staffing and recruiting industry, both on the corporate side and the supplier side. I've recently also completed a master's degree in psychology, specializing in gender and sexual fluidity. And have worked to try to combine those two learnings and love into what I'm doing today.
That's awesome. And I feel like this is going to be a large premise of our dialogue today, is really just getting your insight. You know, my base pay is going to be lucky to be able to have a few edusaries with you, where you are really talking about the value proposition that the supplier side can play within, the whole game of diversity, equity, and inclusion. But before we get into that, I really would be curious to know, what was that moment for you where you're like, you know, I want to do this on my own. I feel like this is a time that I can go out and become my own entrepreneur and start Omni Inclusive.
You know, I was thinking about that this morning, and the thing that brought to my mind was how many times I have held myself back in doing what I do now because I didn't think I could do it. And I think a lot of that, I was starting to kind of figure out, like, where did that come from? There's my psychology brain jumping in. And I see a lot of like societal limitations and self-doubt held me back. Like, I didn't think, you know, I grew up in a lower class, blue collar family. I was raised in the South in Arkansas and Texas. I was the first female in my family to join the military. I was the first person in my family to go to college and now have 2 degrees. Wow. I was, you know, as a single mother of 3 children, I was told, you know, there's no way you can make it successfully as a single parent. You can't run a business, you can't have a business and a home. And so there was always those things that I was told I can't do. And for a while I believed them. And yeah, it was, you know, a combination of trusted friends and colleagues and working on my own self, confidence, mm-hmm. to realize, you know, I look back and everything that I've done in my career thus far and in my life, I've been told I couldn't do, and the whole time I could do it. So as an entrepreneur, I kind of anticipated that I would be here maybe 5, maybe 8 years from now. I didn't think I was going to do it now. Cause I was, you know, I have 2 kids still in high school. So I was like, there's no way I can do it now. I'm going to have to wait till they're out of the house. And yeah, it's just, you know, I sometimes I could smack myself for holding myself back. But for me, you know, when it comes more specifically to the work that we do with Omni Inclusive, you know, being diversity and inclusion focused, being staffing and consulting industry, you know, it was my love of, you know, my nearly 20-ish years in the HR and staffing world, my love of psychology and that sense of belonging. We spend a large amount of our time at work, away from our family, away from our loved ones. You should like where you are and you should feel like you belong where you are. And so that's just really kind of driven me of like, how can I pull all of these things together to be one thing that I do all day, every day. And that's what I'm doing now.
Fantastic. Gwen, major kudos to you and everything that you have led up to this point. And I really hope that it's only the beginning as you embark on this new chapter with Omni Inclusive, because you guys have, you know, you've started the company, I think about a year now. Is that right?
So I started doing some of this external workforce focused inclusion about a year, year and a half ago, but I still, you know, had full-time corporate roles and supplier roles. Mm-hmm. The formalizing Omni Inclusive and taking it full-time has only happened in the past few months. Okay. But there's a lot of background and history and industry expertise that goes into that. I've got some fantastic, a fantastic partner and you know, business partnerships with other firms too, to, you know, get us off the ground and running.
That's wonderful. And I really hope that those words can encourage some of our listeners today on us, you know, being in that corner and knowing that sometimes your own greatest worst enemy is yourself. And I received some really good advice the other day from John Younger, is when you're saying all these accolades, make sure to also mention the fact that you deserve it. So you deserve it when, and you deserve where you've gotten to this point. And definitely have a champion here on my side that is admiring you from the sidelines. But yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, if a little girl raised in a single wide trailer in Arkansas can be where I am today, anybody can do this. I didn't do anything special. I just worked hard.
That's awesome. I love that. And as being the little girl who was raised in a lower income, one of seven kids, mm-hmm. I respect that. And I hope that many of our female listeners and those who feel like, you know, hey, we've gotten to a long road and we made it through, it's just working our butt off, can find some inspiration from that as well. But let's get into things that excite you on what's happening right now within staffing and talent. I think that we're at a very pivotal time, you know, the world of staffing and talent and the way in which talent is being delivered is vastly changing and evolving around us right now. We have online staffing platforms that is maybe going to the buyer and really reanalyzing some of the ways that talent is delivered. So as a staffing agency owner, what are some of those ideas and trends that are really exciting you within the talent acquisition space?
Absolutely. You know, the first trend that I think about, and I think a lot of people associate me with, is direct sourcing. Right. Back in 2016, while I was working with Thomson Reuters, we rolled out one of the first industries direct sourcing programs within contingent labor, utilizing the client brand to attract talent directly, thus reducing our overall markup cost, being able to better partner with suppliers and have an ownership and control of the messaging and the brand that comes out there. That's something I still hold very near and dear to my heart, that labor of love and program. That was one of the first things I was really a part of, where we were trying something that the industry, actually a lot of the industry, thought it was never going to work. And it was one of those things where, you know, I still remember, you know, that first year that we rolled that out, we had not only suppliers and MSPs, but buyers going, what are you doing? This will never work. And then a year later it was, okay, how did you do that? and it was one of those, you know, we kind of came to it as a, you know, let's try it. The worst case scenario, if it doesn't work, we just go back to what we were doing. I think for me, that was one of those big experiences that ripped the Band-Aid off of trying things. And I've always had this passion for workplace inclusion. And what I find is in the industry, we have for maybe decades now talked about workplace inclusion, but only for permanent employees and not for our external workforce. And our external workforce is over 40% of the workers that are out there, the gig economy, the contractors, the consultants, the SOW workers. Someone has to own their belonging and inclusion as well. And I remember, you know, at a time, maybe a few years back, making comments like that at staffing events or whatever. And, you know, of course, I got the same old direct sourcing look where people looked at me like I was insane. And, but we can't keep doing that. We can't keep talking about true workplace inclusion and excluding part of the, a large part of the workforce. And so, you know, that, again, that, you know, going back to direct sourcing, that direct sourcing made me see you can try something and see where it goes. And so it's just been a natural progression for me to look at, you know, we looked at the experience of how contractors are attracted to roles. Now we need to look at the experience of their sense of belonging and retention within roles.
That's incredible. And just for our listeners out there, because I think that we're all workforce nerds and geeks about this, it's pretty cool to sit here and be able to talk about basically, you know, I'm looking at you as one of the pioneers within the direct sourcing program, especially at a company like Thomson Reuters. I always have trouble pronouncing that.
Yeah, Thomson Reuters. That's, yeah, Thomson Reuters. There's two families there from a really long time ago.
they came and made this mega conglomerate of companies. Exactly. But, you know, I want to pick your brain a little bit about what that experience was like. But furthermore, you touched on something that I think is so impactful. And that's the fact of how is DE&I measured and tracked within the external workforce, which right now we're looking at a blank slate. I'm not sure if this has been talked about enough where we can really see this representation, because we're now living in a working world where permanent employees are right alongside the contingent staff for the major projects that are happening at corporations and companies all over the country. And as you said, they make up 40% of the workforce today. So what do you think some of the things that are happening at Omni Inclusive to help better understand the data behind the contingent workforce and truly where that DE&I representation is coming from?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is when we talk about how is the DE&I information tracked for contingent labor, for external labor, and we seem to think that we have to track it differently than perm labor. It's actually tracked the exact, they're the same people. it's the same way. And for most US-based companies, it's following the EEOC guidelines, making sure that you're tracking the categories that, unfortunately, I think there should be more categories, but, you know, tracking what we can, tracking what we know. But the tricky part of the contingent labor world is who tracks that. Who tracks that? Who reports it? Who can know this information? That's where we're confused right now. Because in a perm world, it's the, you know, the employer tracks it because they're the, you know, they're the employer of record. You know, they report it to themselves, HR, leadership, C-suite, they all know this information. But, you know, when we look into, and we're still in the early stages, like you mentioned, when we look into how should we be tracking D&I information for contingent labor, it starts with the employer of record. Those staffing providers, the payroll providers, the EOR should be collecting that information, collecting the information. And then we have to figure out how to report that information up through multiple suppliers into MSPs or programs, from MSPs or program, PMOs to the client for relevant information. And that's where we're starting to still try to figure out the right way to do this. And there's no, you know, just like, you know, again, going back to direct sourcing, there's no one way to do direct sourcing. There's no one way to report this information. So, you know, can we do a combination of suppliers providing the, you know, I would say, well, this is my military world of data masked information, right. Providing that data masked information, you know, it has to come up in a funnel. And what companies should be doing is taking a look at that against local census against information that's available. So understand, and you should be looking at it not to say how diverse are we. I've heard so many C-suite people in the past few years say, I cringe when I hear this, when I hear a leader go, "We're pretty diverse." None of us are pretty diverse. None of us are. It's not looking at the data to see how diverse you already are. It's looking at the data to understand your gaps, because this is not cookie cutter. Just like, so, and you know, I make a lot of comparisons to direct sourcing. Direct sourcing was a process, and there was a methodical way to roll out a process. We're talking about systemic stigma, racism, homophobia, gender phobia, issues, you know, stigma and discrimination in the workplace. We have to be a little more gentle with the way that we're looking at this information. And we have to, it's going to feel like baby steps to get a little bit further in a sense of belonging and inclusion in that workforce.
And it really just begins at, you know, analyzing information that you should be already collecting. I'm thinking as far as a supplier goes, taking a step further and utilizing that as a value proposition to the buyer to know that you're tracking this information, not only tracking it, but repurposing it and really seeing, you know, as you mentioned, where do the gaps lie? Where can we be a better supplier? We're here. We look for and have placed this type of temporary workforce. That's a value proposition for you, Mr. Buyer. Whenever we are going through the supplier setup process. So I think that's an incredible piece of advice that you've given. Now I want to take it a step back here. Because, you know, just touching on the direct sourcing program that you guys have built, or that you have been a part of the build for, what are some of the lessons learned? You know, I would say, what are your top three takeaways on building that program? Because it seems to be a hot button trend. If you open up any SIA newsletter that's happening right now, or many of the reports and studies that are happening, what would be your top three takeaways from that program, since you guys have had something like that under the belt for a few years now?
You know, and obviously I look at that from a buyer perspective, because I was the buyer when we created that program. Right. The number one thing that I advocated in the industry was transparency. Transparency with your suppliers, transparency with your VMS, transparency all around. There's no reason for us to hide the strategy of what we're doing. If you let your suppliers know what you're planning on doing and what's going to happen next, it helps them understand how to support you it's not all about, and to all my buyer friends, I love you and I'm so sorry. It's not all about what the buyer needs, that we have to all be in it together. You know, you have to, as a buyer, you have to look at the perspective of, yes, this program works for me, but I need to be conscious that to understand this may not work for the supplier in question in my program. And that's okay. It's not burned bridges when a supplier needs to walk away from a program because it doesn't fit with their structure. And not everything fits, you know, not everybody fits with everything. You know, when it comes to, you know, that transparency is key. Understanding exactly where you're going to next. What do you need to know? Again, with the direct sourcing program, I provided monthly stats to the suppliers to say, this is how much direct sourcing I'm filling. This is how much you're filling. Wow. Here's where I need you. Yeah. Here's where I don't need you. Here's how our relationships are going to change. And I even saw that in the program where, you know, we went from suppliers that we were a national account, and they said, you know, because of the changing program, we're going to have to reassign you to a regional account. And I said, that makes perfect sense. I absolutely get it. Like, then I was never offended that a supplier needed to rethink about how their relationship is with the with us as a business. I get it. And so, you know, that was a huge piece. I was a little spoiled on the Thomson Reuters side, because one of the things that we did out of direct sourcing, so we started in 2016. By 2019, we were capturing diversity and inclusion information for our contingent labor program. So the program has about 3 years now of DE&I information. And we were able to do that because 80% of the contingent labor was coming through one supplier. So because we were doing the curation and that fed to our EOR, because the pre-identifies also fed to the EOR, I didn't have to battle with 50, 60, 70 suppliers to get diversity information. That is one proponent of the ease of direct sourcing. The ease of direct sourcing can also make your reporting and your control of diversity and inclusion programs a lot easier. Now, if you're a company that doesn't have a direct sourcing model and doesn't want to do a model, can you still do D&I programs? Absolutely. You're just going to have a lot more hands in the cookie jar. And so that's where you have to be a little strategic on how are you going to get information from multiple suppliers collected into one and reportable to something that makes sense to you, the buyer, to say, this tells me what my gaps are. This tells me what I need to improve.
And it's about prioritizing it. How important is it for your organization to track this information? If it is, then this needs to be some form of a requisite for the suppliers to know in advance and know that they need to have that information readily available. Now, I take it to the other end of the spectrum. What keeps you up at night as a staffing agency owner? And I'm sure at the top of the list for many of those that have been acutely aware of what's happening is the direct sourcing trend. What is that advice that you would give them? And I love the example that you gave on how transparent you are with your suppliers. But as for any staffing agency owners that are out there listening in on today's podcast, what would be some of that advice?
To go back to your question of what keeps me up at night, the what keeps me up at night question is, am I doing enough? Mm-hmm. I have a tendency to take on a hell of a lot more than I probably should. and I've had to learn to say no.
Guilty. Yes.
I want to do all of the things all of the time.
Right.
And, when it comes to the world of D&I, I want to touch everything, but I'm not an expert on everything. And even the things, when you think you're an expert, you're never really an expert. Or that's your first flaw. If you think you're an expert on something, there's always something to learn. I have to remind myself to take a step back and go, and what is the lane I'm trying to focus on for this year? And then I can add to it slowly. And so, I kind of go back to my, right on the top of my website is a quote that I live by from Arthur Ashe. And it says, do what you can, use what you have. And this world of D&I feels overwhelming many times. And especially as a white person that has power and privilege, how can I make a change? How can I affect? And I have to use what I have, start where I am. And for me, it's okay, I need to take a step back. My expertise is in the LGBT community, the veteran community, and even the female community. That's where I can impact. Do I care about the other communities? Absolutely. And I will partner with people that I need to make sure that I'm uplifting people of color, neurodiverse, disability groups, and others. I want to do all of it. I know I can't do all of it. I gotta recognize my limitations.
Must have figured out a way to clone you somehow.
Yeah, no. I mean, I made three of myself. They're boys, but they're not the same as me. But keeping in mind what lane I need to stay in. Mm-hmm. And I want to go, I have this world of consulting, D&I consulting and education that I love, but I also need to keep in mind of the recruitment side too, because you actually need both. You can't just do diversity recruiting and you can't just do diversity consulting as a client.
Hand in hand, right?
Yeah. You really need both of those to complement each other.
What do you think, going back to D&I programs, what do you think are some of those strategies that would help attract and retain top talent? And what do you think are some of the more common mistakes that happen when companies are building D&I programs? I know that's kind of somewhat of a loaded question, but I'd love to hear the best practices when building a D&I program and the worst practices that people, of a company look to build in a successful or unsuccessful D&I program.
You know, the best practices are tailored to the company in question. Not every company has the same D&I issues, and not every diversity group needs the same resources. That I think that's one of the, I mean, I don't want to jump too quickly to mistakes, but that's one of the most common mistakes is we think that this is a cookie cutter thing. The resources that women need are not the same resources that male colleagues need. The resources that, I even break it down into the LGBTQ community, the resources that someone needs based on their sexual attraction is not the same resources you need based on your gender identity. Those are not the same thing. Right. And we often lump people into groups, even look at, I'd say, if you take a look at the services that we provide, that companies provide for people of color, do we specify men of color versus women of color? We don't. We throw everybody together, but they don't need the same resources. And there are different things, there are different stigmas and things that need to be addressed there. That's one of the biggest mistakes that I see is not understanding what you need. But the biggest thing that companies can do is say, understand step one, start where you are. What are my gaps? Understand the data to understand where my gaps are. Then put in the things that I need. If I need to attract more LGBT candidates, then posting roles on job boards that have nothing to do with LGBT are not going to get me there. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I would say, my biggest, issue or mistakes for companies is that we focus only on recruitment and not retention. We think that recruitment will save us and retention doesn't need to happen. And it's a, I always look at, the words diversity and inclusion. We call this world D&I. And companies for the past decades have focused on the first word and assumed the second word will just happen. But in reality, diversity is a noun. You're not doing anything. Diverse, we are already diverse. How we exist is diverse. Inclusion is the action. That's the verb. And that's the thing you need to be doing. And when you look at companies that come up and say, we need to have more D&I, what do? Is they say, we need to recruit more diverse talent. And that's going to solve our problem. But recruiting is diversity. Retention is inclusion. What are you doing to do the action verb? And that is the retention. Looking at your policies, looking at your programs, do your medical coverages cover all the needs of your employees? It's not just having BRGs, business resource groups, that, for the LGBT group, they get their focus in June for Pride Month. For the veteran group, they get their focus in November for Veterans Day, and that's it. For the Black Employee Network, they get their focus in February for Black History Month. Like, we need your help all of the months, not just the month that you've set aside for us.
Yeah, that's powerful. And we were talking right before we pressed record on the latest Gallup poll that was released last Thursday, up and doubled from the last 10 years, is the number of workers that were surveyed within that poll. 7% or over 7% of the total workforce population identifies themselves as LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. And that number is only going to expect to rise with Gen Z, who is a generation that has been more open to identifying themselves, to coming out. And some indications have expressed that 20% of the adult population could soon be made up of LGBTQ. So what are some, first of all, thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on that? And then secondly, really creating a formidable program that is welcoming to this increasing population of workers that have now identified themselves and come out to identify themselves as part of that community.
Yeah, The Gallup poll showing that 7.1% of U.S. adults identify as LGBTQ, that is only the percentage of the out population. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we have more people who are in the LGBTQ community or suddenly becoming LGBTQ. We have always been. It's just that we are now becoming in a society that is more open, more safe, and people are feeling more seen and heard and feel safe to say who they truly are.
So some progress on that front, correct? Because now we are creating this environment where these numbers are increasing.
Yeah, I mean, there are progress for that. You know, for every step forward, we have a few steps back. And I think that's the struggle that we work with. You know, does that mean that our discrimination in the LGBTQ community is dwindling? Absolutely not. You know, in the past, I think it was 2020 into early 2021, there were over 100 new laws written by legislation to exclude transgender children or transgender students from anywhere from sports to public restroom use to equality in school, using proper names and pronouns. I mean, there's still a push against. And by far, the transgender and non-binary, but more transgender than non-binary community, are still the number one discriminated workforce or discriminated employee group in the workforce. And if you put in the intersectionality of individuals who are trans and people of color, their numbers are more than doubled. So it's still an area that needs a huge focus. I think, you know, it's company leadership having to come to some serious, come to some serious realizations of the change in their culture. Again, like I had mentioned, you know, the gender, the identity versus attraction are two different areas of the LGBTQ community, and they are not one and the same. An individual can be non-binary and by orientation, by, you know, sexual attraction, be straight or hetero. An individual can be a trans woman and be bisexual or pansexual. Like, there is a combination, and the whole identity is a spectrum. And if you take a look back, I think what I see differently is, you know, in the 1950s, gender was created as a construct, and it was created by our society to label how people would behave based on their sex assigned at birth. If you were male assigned at birth, these are the behaviors that we expect from you. If you were female assigned at birth, these are the behaviors that we expect from you. If you look and appear female or woman versus male or man, this is what is expected. And in the past 56, well, now that's 70 years, we are breaking down that construct of, you know, the idea that behaviors have a gender there's no science behind it. There's actually, there's been actually a lot of studies in the past couple of years to show that out of all the factors, you know, whether it's aggressiveness, assertiveness, shyness, introvert, extrovert, male and females share over 80% of the same behavioral processes. We are 80% more alike than we are different. So that's the idea, you know, this idea of people saying, you know, or people identifying more in the LGBTQ category. And I definitely see more in the Gen Z identifying in a gender spectrum, whether it's non-binary, gender fluid. I myself identify as gender non-conforming. You know, I think there's confusion on what all that means. And the reason there's confusion on what that means is because we are a gendered society, we don't have the language to explain it. Like, the words don't exist to really explain how, you know, what does it mean to be gender nonconforming? What does it mean to be, yes, female, but no, not woman, but maybe a little bit. And, you know, it's, we have to, we're developing the words to help others understand. The words aren't for ourselves. Like, I don't need the words to understand, but I use the words to help others understand. That probably sounded really confusing.
Well, I think it comes back to, you know, as an executive at a company with a long-term talent strategy, coming to the cold realization that this is happening, right? Or maybe not cold, maybe it's warm. Maybe the realization that one out of every five adults within the Gen Z population is going to identify themselves as LGBTQ. And that is going to be a major segment of what is the future workforce. And it is now, as we know from the latest Gallup poll, really growing. What am I going to do to be more welcoming to that? And it comes down to educating myself on what I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned a lot of these things, and I, as a listener, I'm like, well, I need to research that. How can we better track that information and make that inclusion as part of the process for this new line of workers? And, you know, realizing and educating, I think, is really mm-hmm. where it starts with. Now, I want to take it a step back, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, because we had a chance to talk about this in our initial discussion, but what pivotal role does that intermediary play as a staffing agency owner, as a consultant, as somebody that is speaking to the client on their DE&I program when it comes to, you know, the staffing and recruiting partner and them being a part of that process on the DE&I mm-hmm. movement and part of that ecosystem?
You know, we play a very, I'm just going to say we play a very walk on eggshells delicate role, mm-hmm. because while as a supplier, we are responsible for the diversity and inclusion of our staff, mm-hmm. the buyer is still the decision maker. Right. And we have to walk that thin line of gently providing guidance and training to the buyer to help us push that along. I think there are a lot of people that are not ready to hear that while we have all of these diversity supplier initiatives and diversity owned processes, you know, I've heard a lot of buyers in the past say, you know, I have these diverse suppliers, but they bring me non-diverse candidates. Well, the reality is we bring you what you will take. Hmm. And that's what so it's not 100% the supplier's fault. We are in it together. We are 100% in it together. We as a supplier need to do a better job of providing an inclusive workforce. But you as the client, you're the decider of who comes onto your site and works your project. If your management style is not selecting that diverse talent, you need to be part of the solution with us. We have to do this together. And I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of buyer companies that are not ready to make that realization that they are part of the problem. We are all part of the problem, but we are all have to be part of the solution as well.
That's pretty incredible. Wow. And I think that if that is a priority for the client, then it comes down to that full-fledged, very transparent conversation from the supplier to say, we are in this together. This has to be a two-way street mm-hmm. in order for us to create an effective program. What does the future of work look like for you?
Oh, it is exciting for sure. You know, the thing I always say, I feel like I was born in the wrong generation. Like I mentally am a Gen Z person, but my eyes and my knees remind me that I'm Gen X.
Your knees.
My knees, especially. This idea of that, you know, we have workplace equality regardless of your gender, your sex assigned at birth, your identity, your race, your ethnicity, your culture. Like, we are all just people at a job, getting something done, bringing home a paycheck to take care of our families. That's what it's about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that we doing the work to make sure that we identify our biases. It's not that we eradicate bias. A bias is human nature. I don't know. I mean, if we could eradicate it, I'd be all for it, but I don't think we can. Everybody has bias. It's understanding, recognizing your bias, recognizing your privilege, and how are you going to change your behavior? Like, what do you do to change that? What do you do to be better a little bit every day? And, you know, I see a world where, I mean, again, this is might be a spot where people think I'm nuts, but I see a world where perm employees and contract employees are interchangeable. I don't know that it's going to matter. It's not going to matter where you come from. It's that we get the job done. And we're, you know, I think in the staffing world, a lot of us are ready for that. We just have legislation that hasn't caught up with us yet. And so, I mean, the same thing with the diversity and inclusion reporting on EEOC. EEOC's diversity and inclusion reporting on gender only recognizes man and woman. First of all, actually, yeah, it's actually sex. It's sex and man and woman. Man and woman are not a sex. Male and female are a sex. Those are genders, but you're only recognizing two genders, when in reality, there are more than 70 gender identities that we know of. So that, again, we're, what we have to work with is a little behind where we are. And I am super excited to see what Generation Z brings into the workplace. I know as a young Gen Xer, I think we were called Zennials, like the uproar of what millennials brought to the workplace. I saw it from the beginning. And then, but now I'm like, good for them. Cause you know what? We got a lot more vacation time out of it and workplace balance and hybrid remote work.
That's right.
I don't know that us Gen Xers would have fought for. We were just kind of like, we'll go with it. They say work all day and we go, all right. Yeah, we never really fought for it.
That is too funny.
But yeah, to see what the next generation will bring in from an equality perspective. And I think I saw a poll about a year ago that said over 68% of applicants would turn down a job offer if the company's values did not match their own. That already is the most important thing that your job seekers are looking for right now. What do you stand for as a company?
They're checking out your social media. They're checking out what you represent, where you stand on things.
And I hear all the time, you know, especially in this like great labor shortage. I don't know that there's labor shortage. I don't agree that the fact that there's labor shortage, what I hear companies saying is we're struggling to find people for jobs. I said, there's actually a lot of people looking for work. What are you doing as a company to stand out? How do I see your job posting over the hundreds of job postings and say, that's a place I want to go work? If you're as a company not standing out, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm. That's incredible. So future of work for WIN is mainly boiled down to seeing what Gen Z can do and what they're going to be bringing in. A workplace that basically, forgive me for those that are listening that take offense to this, but the antiquated FTE model is coming to an extinction, and, you know, skill-based hiring, project-based hiring, whatever kind of based hiring is going to be the new norm, and really seeing what companies are going to be doing to educate themselves on hopefully, guys, we can rely on a government that evolves as quickly as it needs to with the things that are rapidly changing.
Can I say a lot more diversity in the C-suites?
Yeah.
I'm really tired of seeing the same old faces in the C-suites. I mean, no offense, but
yes, I would agree.
8%. I think less than 8% of C-suiters, CEOs are female. It's just, we got to knock that off.
Wow. Yeah, that would be wonderful to see happen in the future work. And I think, you are a large part of that. Now, I'm very curious to this next question, and this is going to be as we wrap it up on today. And I encourage those that are listening in to also take a peek at the educational series that WIN's going to be doing with us in partnering with MyBasePay on some of these topics, which I am just sincerely fascinated with. But I would love to know, WIN, what is your content diet? Where can I learn this information? Where can I educate myself as an executive, as somebody that is leading, as somebody that is genuinely interested in seeing how do we make this up and understand what is a part of the contingent workforce? Where can I learn? Where is your content diet?
You know, a lot of my content diet right now is networking. So I'm heavily involved in the Twin Cities Society for Human Resource Management, TC SHRM. I have recently joined the university relations team. Again, I told you, I'm a huge fan of Gen Z. So what do I actually, as a leader, want to learn from the incoming HR professionals? So the best way that I can do that is, you know, be that, you set up programs to help guide and mentor those university students. Our local LGBT Chamber of Commerce in the Twin Cities is a group called Quorum. And I absolutely love Quorum. It is fantastic. It's a fantastic community to meet and network with other LGBT entrepreneurs, professionals, and business owners. Almost every major city has their own NGLCC group. I highly recommend people to work into knowing those. I've actually recently agreed to create a committee on at Quorum for the young LGBTQ professionals in the Twin Cities. So some stuff will be coming for that. I'm on the advisory panel at Minnesota State University for the Women in Leadership Certificate Program. That's been a fantastic program they've put together all online to help women take that next step into their career. And whether it's becoming a VP, a president, an entrepreneur, a business owner, you know, it's giving us the tools that I don't know that we always got, you know, early on in our career. I very much, when I go again, going back to my past, my family of origin, all the women in my family were either stay-at-home moms or administrative professionals. And while there is absolutely nothing wrong, and those are honorable roles, I wanted something different. But there was nothing, you know, there wasn't anything to say, okay, take it. I'm seeing a heck of a lot more of that now.
Here's some stuff to help you get to that point.
Yeah, like the college and career prep I see for my kids in high school now, nowhere near, I didn't have any of that. It was graduate.
Teach you how to type and answer.
Yeah, I learned how to type. And it the goal was graduate without becoming pregnant first. And I did that. So now what? And then on the veteran side, there are a lot of local groups that help transition veterans from the military world to the civilian world. The group I'm involved with here in the Twin Cities is Eagles Group of Minnesota. We do everything from doing educational to helping connect veterans to companies that they want to interview. You know, I talk a lot about that too on, you know, it's a little bit of both. We spend so much time trying to help the diverse group learn how to speak the corporate world when they're not the problem. We need to be teaching the companies how to speak the different cultures. And so, you know, you see a lot of where we try to teach veterans how to write a resume, how to interview for civilian jobs, how to take their military experience and articulate it into civilian speak. But what are we doing to help companies understand how to interpret military work? There needs to be on both sides. And so I love that kind of work. And then specifically in the LGBT community, I like a couple of websites that I really, and resources I recommend people to look at. The Human Rights Campaign is a valuable place for education. They have a lot of reports, a lot of industry surveys, a lot of information out there, not only from the personal life perspective, but from a company life perspective too. Another one is a group called Out Leadership. They have a website and it is all about LGBTQ professionals in the workplace. The Trevor Project is a huge one that's near and dear to my heart. That is more about supporting LGBTQ youth. And there is everything from hotlines to talk to somebody, you know, for the youth. And when they say youth, I believe their age ranges are like 12 or 13 to 25. They're providing support for those individuals as they're going through their journey of self-discovery and understanding who they are and who they become in the world. There are support for parents. There are support for family members. It's just a fantastic organization. And then finally, going back to my company, my old company roots, Thomson Reuters, Reuters has its own news outlet called Openly, and it is an LGBTQ-focused news outlet, openlynews.com. You'll see the latest and greatest about LGBT-based news and what's going on in the world.
Wow, fantastic. Definitely a few that I'm going to be researching myself as a personal learner and grower within this wonderful new movement that we see taking shape in the workforce. Wen, thank you so much for your time today. You are a plethora of knowledge, and it's fantastic to just be able to pick your brain on a few of these things. Where can we find you and get a hold of Wen Stanger if we wanted to get some more information from you?
You can find me on my website. It is omniinclusive.com. You can email me at info@omniinclusive.com, or you can find me ever publicly opinionated on LinkedIn.
Yes, absolutely. Wen, thank you once again for sitting down and chatting with the Ivy podcast. Thank you to our listeners as well for tuning in. I know that so many people listening will find great value in today's session. So appreciate it on all fronts. And we will catch you guys on the next Ivy podcast episode.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.